Something later. But you know, I couldn't go to sleep. I was awake when he came home. It was just such a night to share, you know, together. Because that night we were, you know, in the same bed. Then the next morning, getting up and getting dressed, and the snowstorm, all the excitement, leaving our house. I never thought then that I was leaving it for the last time. I mean, I never thought of, you know, being sort of saying goodbye to it. Mm-hmm. And then going to the White House, and we all had coffee in the Red Room before. I remember sitting on that sofa next to Mrs. Nixon, who looked really pretty that day. I thought if she, you could see she could really be rather New York chic when she wanted,
right,
in sort of a black Persian lamb coat and hat. And Mrs. Eisenhower, it was very nice, you know, everybody was there drinking coffee and things. And as we left, I rode with Stiles, Bridges, and Mamie Eisenhower to the Capitol. And as we were sitting in the car, I guess the president and President Eisenhower and Jack came out after us. I mean, she said, "Look at Ike in his top hat. He looks just like Paddy the Irishman." And then I think she went. And then on the way to the Capitol, she said that it would be the first time in her life tonight when she would dial her own telephone number, because she'd had a switchboard for 30 years. So that was her big... You know, I kept thinking how those people have been taken care of all their life. But anyway, you know, it was rather making conversation up there. Then, well, you know, all the inauguration and Cardinal Cushing and the lectern burning, and then poor Robert Frost.
It was a marvelous picture of the expression of anxiety in your face and solicitude
with
Robert Frost. What happened?
Well, you could see him. It was such a glare from the snow that he really couldn't see what was written on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lyndon got up and held his hat over it, but the poor man still couldn't see. And he looked like he was going to cry. He just sounded so sad. But then, thank heavens, he knew, you know, that he said that, what is it, the gift outright and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, and watching Jack when he said that and everything. And then I never had a chance. You know, as I was sitting about three away, and everyone says, "Why didn't Jack kiss you after?" Which, of course, you would never do there. But you had to march out in such order that I was about eight behind him with women or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I so badly wanted to see him before the lunch, just to see him alone. I went to a room with all the ladies where they had sherry and coffee, and he was with the men. And I caught up to him in the Capitol, and I was just so proud of him. And there's a picture where I have my hand on his chin, and you know, he's just looking at me, and there really were tears in his eyes. And that picture was in the, suddenly a flash came, because I didn't think there was anyone there. In the papers it said, "Wife chucks him under chin." I mean, that was so much more emotional than any kiss. Because
mm-hmm.
his eyes really did fill with tears. I'd just say, "Oh, Jack, you know, what a day." And then the lunch in the old Supreme Court chamber in the Capitol. Remember, everybody was sending their little menu card around to be autographed. It was very jolly. Truman, I sat next to Warren. Then we got in the car for that parade. You know, sort of not quite knowing how to wave.
Yes.
And then when we got to the White House, I guess we went in for a minute and walked out to the stand. Oh, Jack was just so happy. They had hot soup or something in that stand, and him to stand, and he wanted to see every single bit of that parade. He was just so proud, and he was, they keep telling us how it would be running late. And I left after a couple of hours, because again, I was really so tired that day. And, but he stayed until just nightfall. I think he was the last person there. No, and came in, then everybody, there was a big reception downstairs. Again, I was in bed. And that night, he was to go to a dinner for all the cabinet at Jane Wheeler's. And I was to stay and have dinner in bed and everything, and he would come back and pick me up to go to the first ball. And about 9 o'clock or something, when it was time to start getting dressed, again I couldn't get out of bed. I just couldn't move. And so I called up Dr. Travell, just frantic, and she came running over. She had 2 pills, a green one and an orange one, and she told me to take the orange one, so I did, and I said, what is it? And then she told me it was Dexedrine, which I'd never taken in my life. But, and then I never have again. But thank God, it really did its trick. Because then you could get dressed, and then Jack came, and he came upstairs, and he brought me down to the red room. There were a few people with the Foleys, I remember. We all had a toast of champagne, and he did... You know, he liked how I looked, and he said something so nice, and we went off to that ball. And the old... was so funny with the aides, because the old aide, the head of the White House aide, kept trying to be with Jack all evening, and the other three were jumping in and out. And then to come into that ball, that was exciting. And, you know, there's that wonderful picture of him sort of pointing. Mm-hmm. I mean, then we went to one at the Mayflower, where Lyndon was right next to us at that one. And then we went to a third one at the Wardman Park, and just on the way, it was like Cinderella and the clock striking midnight. I guess that pill wore off, because I just couldn't get out of the car. And so Jack said, you go home now, and he sent me home with that aide. And I guess he went on to all the other balls, and then to Joe Alsop's.
I was staying with Joe then.
And I was so happy. Sometimes I thought later, I wish I'd been able to sort of share all that night with him. But he had such a wonderful time, and he must have gotten home about 3 or 4, but he came in and woke me up. And I slept in the Queen's room. He slept in the Lincoln room then, so that was his first night in Lincoln's bed. Mm-hmm. And, well, he was just so happy. Then the next morning when he woke up very early, well, I was awake too, and so I went in that room, and it's the sunniest room. You know, we both sat in that bed. I mean, you did again feel like 2 children. Think of yourself sitting in Lincoln's bed. I don't know. And he went off with that wonderful springing step to his office, and then again, I told you, come crashing back with Truman, with Robert Frost. It was such happy days for him. He couldn't wait to get the children back. And all that end smelled so of paint, but he keeps saying, you've got to bring them back soon. He really missed them. I guess they came back about 2 weeks later.
What was your theory of sort of relaxation and entertainment at the beginning at the White House?
Was really what it had always been. Jack was so like his father in that he hated to leave his house, whether it was Georgetown, the Cape, whether we had my mother's house in Newport, and even in the White House, he hated to go out.
He always hated to go out?
Yeah, and you know, his father loved to stay home, and he thought he had the best food and everything that's best in your house. So Jack was brought up, you know, as long as everything was nice at home. He loved to go to Joe's because the food was always so good. So it was exactly as it had been in the past. You'd have the Bartletts or David Gore, who was... David Gore was around just after inauguration. He wasn't ambassador yet. Or Max Friedman once, or... You know, and he was just suppers and trays then, or if any of his family were down, or...
You went out more that first winter than later.
We only went out about twice that first winter. But everybody, because it, 3 times. Once to Lorraine Cooper's, because Jack, it was the first time we ever went out. And Jack loved Cooper, and you know, he didn't really want to go to that dinner, because Lorraine's dinners were always so big, it really wasn't much fun for him. And then we went once to Joe's when Jack, and once to Rowley's. Mm-hmm. Jack Whitney was at Rowley's, and everybody, they found out about that because the snow plows came and scraped off Rowley Street before us, I mean. So because those three things caused such commotion, you'd think we went out every night. Those were the only three times. And I forget who we went to Joe's for. Then we really stopped, maybe once in the spring again we went to Joe's. But we hardly ever went out after. You know, it proved just such a production and everything. Mm. It was really more fun to have people come to you. He liked also, you know, he'd always work very late. And you'd always have to juggle the children's naps or something, so they'd be there when he came home. He liked to see them for about a half an hour before dinner. And, well, if you were going out and you had to take a bath and change and leave, it was just a nuisance. Mm-hmm. So, that's one thing that you never missed, being in the White House.
How about, how often would you have movies, for example?
Not very often. Gosh, we didn't, I don't know, maybe four times a year or something.
Oh, more than that, surely.
Well, the first winter we might have had a few, really not very many, because I can only think of about four or five that we saw the whole time there. I think in the summer you might have some.
Because it seems to me, I'm sure I've seen that many with you or him.
I think I can.
None of which he ever stayed for more than about half an hour.
I remember the Frenchman, the last year at Marion Bath, we hated that.
Yes.
Yeah, or sometimes there'd be a USIA thing he'd want me to see, or something, you know, some thing he'd done, but really not so many.
How would he begin the day? What time would he get up?
He'd get up 7:45, and George would come knock on our bedroom door, and then he'd get up and go into his bedroom and have breakfast there. And if I was... you know, sometimes I'd have ring for breakfast at the same time, or I'd sleep a little later. But, and then the children would come in, and it was so incredible, because they'd rush to turn on the television set, and you'd hear this roar, full blast of cartoons or that exercise man. And Jack would be sitting there, he had breakfast in a chair with a tray in front of him, you know, reading 50 morning papers or sheaves of all those briefing books to go over with Bundy, and this racket around. Then he'd take a bath, and I always thought it was so funny for people who used his bathroom, guests. It was the bathroom you would have to, that men could use after dinner, because all along his tub were all these little floating animals, ducks and pink pigs and things, because he said, give me something to do to amuse John while I'm in my bath, so John would float all these things around. And he just could have those children tumbling around him. Then he'd always come in before he went over to the office. You know, come into my room. I mean, I'd only be half asleep or else I'd be having breakfast and see me. And he used to take Caroline over to the office with him every day.
That'd be about 9:30.
Yeah, 7:45. Yeah, or maybe a little earlier, I suppose. He'd be, I guess, over an hour having breakfast, reading the papers, and taking a bath. And later on, it used to be John's treat to walk to the office with him every day.
Had George always been in the White House, or had he always been president, or what?
George had been with Jack when he first came to Congress.
Oh,
he found him. He was with Arthur Crock before, and Arthur told him.
Really?
Jack about him. Then he left for a couple of years and worked for Ethel's mother. Then he came back to us. He wasn't with us at Hickory Hill. He came back 57, and he was with us ever since.
Where is he now?
He's somewhere. I mean, he lives where he, in Washington. He comes to see us a lot. I mean, we'll always take care of him. But poor George, he really got the shakes. I mean, he couldn't. I asked him if he wanted to work here, but he's just too old. He dropped him in the White House. All he'd do, it used to amuse Jack so. He'd open the door so that some other slave could carry in Jack's breakfast tray. The only thing he did was pull open the curtains and then turn on the bath, and then he'd go up, and all the little White House mess boys were shining his shoes and everything.
Then the president would always come back for lunch.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever had lunch in his office, did he?
Never. Unless he had a business lunch, you know, in the family dining room downstairs. Mm-hmm. He always kept our floor. We put in the dining room. You know, he'd keep all his business lunches downstairs, and he knew that that was our private place. It's so different from now, where everyone gets the tour of the bathrooms and things. Maybe because Jack had young children.
And he very rarely liked to have, he didn't like business lunches, did he? It seemed to me that he was very much preferred to see people in his office rather than having lunch in it.
Yeah, they were really heavy. And then he'd come up, you know, they were hard for him. And you know, you're always awfully tired at the end of one of those White House mornings in your office, and your nerves are on edge. So to have to go through a long lunch and wine, and then he'd come up afterwards and still try to take whatever little nap he could. He never took a nap before, but in the White House, I think he made up his mind he would, because it was so good for his health. Something was always cracking up before. And that really kept, and he'd always said that Winston Churchill used to do it, and he'd often say how much more, you know, staying power it gave him. But his naps, my lord, did I tell you about them?
No.
Well, it'd be 45 minutes, and he'd get completely undressed and into his pajamas, and into bed, and go to sleep, and then wake up again. And I often used to...
And he could go to sleep, put himself to sleep, could he?
Yeah. I used to think, for a 45-minute nap, would you bother to take off all your clothes? Or it would take me 45 minutes to just snuggle down and start to doze off. And I often used to, sometimes when he had lunch in his room, in bed he'd have it. I'd have lunch in there with him, and then I'd close the curtains and open the window for his nap, and then I'd wake him up from it. And then I'd sit around while he got dressed. That was my hour, instead of the children's. You know, but it would just be like clockwork, 45 minutes, and he'd be back in his office.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd always work till, well, after 8 at night.
Would he swim every day, or was that on the later part after?
In the beginning, you know, he came to the White House in the best physical condition that he was ever in his life. He had muscles and everything. He played golf, sort of 18 holes, all these things he hadn't been able to do for a long time. And then he sat in his desk without moving for 6 weeks. He didn't walk around the driveway, he didn't swim. And suddenly his back went bad. He'd lost all the muscle tone.
Hmm.
So then it was awful, because he was really in pain. Dr. Travell would pump him full of Novocaine, and finally we got... Oh, out!
Why?
Merely the fact he wasn't exercising.
Yes, you see, he'd never done much exercise anyway, but as he said, the campaign of jumping in and out of cars, walking, you know, kept him fit. And then, for the first time in his life, he'd really had, from election to inauguration, a lot of it in Florida, to play golf, I don't know, twice a week or three times, to swim, to walk on the beach. He'd never had such a long period, you know, of daily some kind of exercise. And he just lost it all sitting in his desk. And then he went back to Dr. Travell. But all that Novocaine, it didn't do any good anymore. You know, it wasn't until the next October I got so mad at her, because then other doctors were trying to bring in Hans Krauss, who could build you up through exercises.
Mm-hmm.
All these doctors are so jealous of each other, and she wouldn't let Krauss come in. And finally, I'd sat by so many times while doctors did things to Jack. You know, while doctors just pushed Jack all over the place, that I really got mad and got in there and got the back surgeon and the other, everybody, and just forced her to have him to have Krauss. And Krauss started these series of exercises, which he did every evening with the Navy chief. You know, like lift, trying to touch your toes, or lying on your stomach and trying to raise one leg. And you could just see, I mean, he still was in pain a lot that winter. It went out really badly, remember, in May in Canada.
Yeah.
But by the next October, when he started to do these, after a while,
But he was wheat before he went to Canada. In other words, yeah. It wasn't the planting the tree in Canada which caused it all. It was really the lack of exercise.
Yeah. And...
How long a day would he exercise?
Oh, well, these exercises with the chief would just take about 15 minutes. Aww. You know, sort of setting up exercises, or then they'd hold your leg so you'd have to try to lift it up against it. But, you know, Jack could never touch his toes. He couldn't get his hands down any farther than his knees standing up. He couldn't put on his shoes before. Sort of bend over that far.
Oh, really?
Well, he could if he lifted his foot in his lap or something. Though, as I say, he wasn't a cripple. That sounds funny. He could do everything. But you just noticed when you'd see him trying to reach for something he dropped on the floor, how stiff he was. My Lord, at the end, in a couple of months, he could touch his toes. He could do all these things he'd never been able to do. Do knee bends. So then once Kraus started, then that was... You know, encouraging, because he'd get so discouraged. That's when you'd see him in black periods. When he tried, and he'd had every doctor, and Dr. Travell had given him the 10th treatment, and before she always helped, and now there just didn't seem to be any answer. So then Kraus then helped him, and that cheered him up.
Your White House parties, best parties I've ever gone to, were they...
Well, I'll tell you why I thought of having them. The one thing I noticed was that I could get away from the White House and I could go to New York and see a play or go to a restaurant. And that's... Jack never liked to go out before when he was in his home, but he had liked to stop in New York a couple of days, see a play, go to Pavillon, you know, see some different people. And you can't be cut off from, I mean, we were young and we were gay, and you couldn't cut all that off from him and just leave his life full of worry. So the first one I thought of having, it was when Lee was over. I thought that would be an excuse to have one. And I thought of all these people from New York or everywhere, the people he wasn't seeing. That's why so few people from Washington sort of came to them in a way. And it turned out, well, he loved it. And, you know, so then he'd say, well, let's have, every now and then, I think we only had about 5 in all. But after 3 or 4 months, or when it had been sort of a ghastly month, and I had such a stiff neck from being tense, or he'd been having a bad time, he'd say, let's have another one of those parties. Well, he just loved them, because then he was sort of a way to renew yourself. He'd always tell me to go visit Lee or go to New York or something when he could see the tension of there was getting me. Because you see, when we came in there, I was very weak. And plus all the thing of the campaign, plus the baby, plus... And to hit that place running and start to do all the work of... running the house, getting a chef, doing the food, the flowers, the reconstruction, restoration, whatever it is. You know, sometimes at the end of the day, you just feel one jump away from tears, but you wanted to be so cheerful for Jack when he came home, which I nearly always was, but he could see when it was getting to be a bit too much. And that first winter, I couldn't sleep very well. He'd always send you away, and when he knew you were tired, and then you come back so happy again. I always think our whole married life was renewals of love after, you know, brief separations.
Where would you go on the weekends in that first...
Glenora.
Glenora.
We didn't use... it's funny, he never thought of using Camp David either. I sort of had this thing about having to get a house in the country, and he'd hated Camp David when he went there with Eisenhower. He said it's the most depressing looking place, which it is from the outside. And Tash Shepherd, his naval aide, kept pestering and pestering him to go there. And Tish used to say to me, the Navy's so hurt and demoralized, you won't go there. So finally one weekend he said, all right, let's go to Camp David. Then he got to rather love it. because it is comfortable in those cabins, and you know you can. So then we go there a bit, but we go to Glenora mostly on weekends, which he didn't like really at all.
Why didn't he like Glenora?
Well, you know, there's nothing for him to do. Camp David, I suppose you could have a movie at night. Mm-hmm. And it's just a rather small, dark house. He liked to see me rye, you know, be happy being out in the air all day. Because he always said Daddy told him, keep her riding and she'll always be in a good mood. Well, in a way, the thing that means is exercise and fresh air. Which is true. You try to make an extra effort every day to go out and play tennis, though I couldn't play it, or just get in the air, walk 10 times around the south lawn. So if you just stay indoors and smoke cigarettes and work at your desk and talk on the telephone till, you know, your throat is all tight, you can't be gay for anyone. Then we start to go to Camp David that spring. But you see, he'd always come down. I think rarely he came Friday evening. He'd always come Saturday, sort of at lunchtime. And then he'd sleep all Saturday afternoon. And then he'd watch all the afternoon television or something from his bed. It was just a letdown for him. And we'd always have a friend for the weekend, have dinner, go to bed early, church the next day, papers, and another nap. You know, as he said, I don't really care about Glenora because all I use it for is to sleep.
Mm-hmm. He preserved his weekends very faithfully. Almost every weekend he went off.
Practically every weekend except which was the 62. You know, there'd be some weekend election things he'd have to do, mm-hmm. or a couple of fundraising things in New York or something. And then this fall, we did have two or three weekends at our new house in Virginia. And
he was off on trips a couple of times.
Tampa, Dallas. You know, because it was a campaign year, you didn't expect to have many.
Mm-hmm. Had you always known Tish? She's an old friend?
I'd known Tish when I was at school in Paris. She was with Mrs. Bruce at the embassy and there. And then when I was in Rome, she was with Mrs. Luce, and she was just such a mountain of energy that I remember just thinking, I can't go in there unless I have Tish, and calling her up right after Jack was nominated. Nominated or elected, I guess it was elected. And, well, Tish is great and I love her, but so much of her energy was rather extra that now that I think of it, she really made me tireder than I'd had to be. Because she'd send you so many extra things that you really didn't have to answer. And on weekends, she'd keep sending folders down till I stopped it. Or as I'd be sitting with Jack in the evening, some messenger would come flying in and throw a folder in my lap. It began to drive me crazy. Then Jack told me that I must stop using my desk in the East Hall, or the West Hall, where we sat. He said, you can't have your desk in the room where we sit and, you know, where we live. So then he made me move it down to the treaty room. And it was so good because often when we'd be alone in the evening, he'd be looking at a book or doing some of his papers, and I'd go grab a folder off my desk and try to check off all the little things I had to do. But it would just put you in not the right atmosphere that you should be in when your husband comes home. And, you know, so he arranged that part of my life. And once it was in the treaty room, you could let fictitious things pile up for days and then go do it all in one big session.
Nancy was much closer friend.
Nancy was my roommate, and ever since she came, the difference that life was, how much more time there was to be able to enjoy, to make yourself so that Jack would enjoy you more. I tried to get her sooner, but she wouldn't come.
Nancy's the nicest girl. She's also a very funny girl and a very sharp one.
Yeah.
Underneath the sort of shy, diffident exterior.
And she's feminine. I mean, Tish is sort of a feminist, really. She used to tell me she loved to have lunch in the White House mess so she could argue with men. she's great, but she was so different from me and just exhausted me so.
How about Pam?
Pam was fantastic because in the beginning I didn't think I'd need a press secretary and a, you know, every other people, the one person had done them both, but when I saw what Tish was like about the press, Jack got so mad. Tish had her own press conference before inauguration at the Sulgrave Club. She was coming there to speak. She got television and everything there. She was laughing and saying, yes, we're going to hang pictures on all the walls, upside down, modern, this, that. And, you know, it really caused trouble. It was the first sort of bad sensational headline. And Jack said, not one of my cabinet officers has had an interview. Would you mind telling me what the hell Tish Baldrige is doing? She just loved the press so that I saw that if I was to keep any privacy of our life, and she was always saying, we got to have Betty Beale to the first steak dinner, I must get someone who had the same reactions I did. And little Pam had been a friend of my sister's. Jack had gotten three of them, Lizzie Condon, who's now in my office, Pam and Nene, jobs in the Senate one summer. And Pam had been in his office. Pam had stayed, the others had gone away and gotten married. And I just knew that she'd have all the same reactions I did. She was going over to work somewhere in the White House anyway. But I asked her if she'd be my press secretary. And she was terrified and she didn't want to. And I told her if she did a good job, if I thought she was doing a good job, the press would always think she wasn't no good. And if they thought she was good, she wouldn't be helping me the way I wanted. So it was very difficult for her. She's very sensitive. But she's just been ideal. And it's been hard for her.
Mm-hmm. She's a great girl. West was, you inherited.
Yes, J.B. West, the chief usher at the White House. He came there under Franklin Roosevelt as an usher because he got to be head usher under Truman. And, he runs that whole place, you know. He was one of the people who contributed most to being happy in that place. Just did everything. I'm running out of superlatives now, energy.
Mrs. Pierce.
Oh, Mrs. Pierce. She couldn't have had better credentials as a curator, you know, everything from winter to around this bright, bright little girl. And Mr. West explained to me what happened to her. Because here, this young little girl came and so excited about what she was doing. And suddenly she'd stop working and letters wouldn't be answered. Someone would have given a $50,000 something, or someone would have written 6 months ago and 6 weeks ago not gotten an answer. And she was always having tea with other curators. And Mr. West said to me, there's something I think I ought to tell you, Mrs. Kennedy. There's a disease around this place which we call White House-itis, and it hits more people, some of them the ones you least expect. And it really hit Lorraine Pierce. One day I found her in Jack's bedroom with Mr. Ginsburg and Levy, who run a, you know, very good furniture, American furniture store in New York. But there in Jack's bedroom, in our private floor, on the floor, looking under his table or his bed. And I said, Lorraine, what are you doing bringing these men up here? She'd get outraged and she'd say unless she could have them inspect the marquetry or something, she was going to write to the president herself. She just got so grand that after a while she stopped being useful. And you had to get rid of her. And she told me it would take 10 years to write the guidebook. And I said, I'm sorry, we don't have 10 years. And if, you know, the president can do all he's doing. So then the little timid mouse registrar Bill Elder came as curator. And he was very good as curator. He never wanted any publicity to see anyone, but he was also so in love with looking at the bottom of furniture and stuff that he never answered a letter or the telephone either, but he was much better. He got over. But finally, Lorraine, with me pressuring her, got things together, and I suppose she and I wrote the guidebook. She'd send a batch of illustrations and do part of the text, and I'd pick all the ones I wanted in. You know, it was like drawing teeth, and Jack used to say, what is wrong with that girl? She had the chance of a lifetime, the best job in America for someone of her field. To have that now with all this interest. And White House-itis just went to her head. Now, Tish got it. Pam never got it. I think very few of the people in Jack's side got it. I don't know, you know more about that. Tish loved to pick up the phone and have White House calling her. Send all the White House china and the plane to Costa Rica or tell them they had to fly string beans into a state dinner. And oh, she sort of arranged Ireland when they said, well, we grow wonderful peas here. You know, just anything that was sort of this power thing. Mm-hmm. And White House itis. It's fascinating. You can see which of your friends it affects that suddenly start to treat you differently. I used to think if I ever wrote a book, it would be called The Poison of the Presidency. Because it poisons so many relationships with people outside.
How would that happen?
Well, some people who don't see you as much as they like would say terrible things about you. Some that were your old friends would always be the same, but others would be so excited about being known that then they'd go tell. Just little tidbits like, I don't know, Caroline said this or that. They'd make up something just to show that they'd been there. Mm-hmm. Or the other people who suddenly never spoke to you before, but start calling you up or trying to send you some marvelous present. I don't know. And one person, Andre Meyer, who was the first person to give to Jack's library, he was this very crusty man, he's head of Lazare Frères in New York, who didn't want to give to the White House. He's sick of being dunned and touched. And when I told him I didn't want him to, then I think he got to like me, and he was the biggest help of all. When Jack died, he came 10 days later with a check for $250,000 for the library before we'd almost even said anything about it. But he said to me once, I used to see him when I go to New York, because he had the apartment under ours at the Carlisle, and I'd be tired up there. I'd just like to go down and have dinner with him. And he said, you will see when you leave the White House, many people who you think were your friends will no longer be. But I will always be your friend, because, and I see it now so well. I mean, I always knew which ones. Everybody's still a friend, but you see the ones who get so excited about power, mm-hmm. and go over to the new, which is fine. You see it in what some people write or give party, you know. And you know, well, you always know. Mr. Kennedy always said, "You can always, if you can count your friends on 5 fingers of one hand, you're lucky." And I have the friends I always knew I'd have.
I met Andre Meyer the other day in New York. I was having dinner with Mendes France, who was also staying at the Carlisle, and they ran into each other in the elevator. Very nice man. He spoke with affection to you.
I sort of think he's rather a misanthrope.
He's crusty.
Until he loves you, and then... And he loved and admired Jack, so without hardly ever knowing him, he always said he was the only he said, I am so ashamed of my colleagues in Wall Street. They do not see what this man is doing, you know.
I think that's enough for today.
Yeah.
The Fifth Conversation, Tuesday, March 24th, 1964.
During the campaign, Cuba emerged as an issue. Had the president been much concerned about Castro? Do you remember in 59 when Castro first came in, what he felt?
Oh, well, I remember how awful he thought it was that he was let in. And, you know, we knew Earl Smith then, who'd been Eisenhower's ambassador at the time, and so there was a lot of, when we were in Florida, that's all Earl could talk about. And yeah, then Jack was so really sort of sick that the Eisenhower administration had let him come in the New York Times, what was his name, Herbert Matthews?
That's right.
I can remember a lot of talk about it, and didn't even Norman Mailer write something?
Norman Mailer was very pro-Castro, yeah.
Yeah. Jack being...
Did Earl Smith think it was talk about communists, Castro as a communist, or working with the communists at that time? He's written a book, as you know.
Yeah, The Fourth Floor. He was always saying his troubles with the State Department. Remember, there was a man named Mr. Rubottom he kept talking about. Mm-hmm. And how hard it was, he was, you know, be warning against Castro. And had just, it was like, I don't know, dropping pennies down an endless well. You just never could get through to the State Department. So I suppose he thought he was a communist, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the president's view then was that, as you say, our policy was wrong, not letting it happen. But he, on the other hand, had no sympathy with Batista.
No. No, I can just remember the talk about it, but, you know, I'm not very good at...
Then came the campaign, and then after the campaign, remember when Alan Dulles came to...
Oh, Alan Dulles came to Hyannis after, yeah. The first two people Jack thought he had to keep were J. Edgar Hoover and Alan Dulles. Mm-hmm. And nice as Alan, well, turned out to be not so.
Nixon in his book wrote that the president had been told during the campaign about this, which was wrong, since Dulles and the president both said he didn't know about it until November, about the fact that we'd been secretly training the Cuban.
Well, he never said to me that he knew anything, so I believe that.
When did you first become aware of all this brewing?
Well, you always knew the Cuba problem, but then wasn't the weeks before it happened, every press conference or every week, there was something about Cuba?
Stories began to appear in March, saying that an invasion was likely or something like that.
And then all the time at his press conferences, Jack would keep having to say United States troops won't be committed or... You know, sort of dodging everything that way. Then I knew about all those people being trained.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember, well, it was like the second time where Keating was going on every week about something, that the missiles weren't out or there were more missiles. I mean, it was just Cuba all the time in one way or another.
Do you remember what the president's feeling was about the invasion before? For example, you mentioned the Fulbright meeting last time.
Well, obviously, leading up to it, he was always uneasy, but the time I really remember well was the weekend before, which would be April 13th and 14th. We were down in Glenora with Jean and Steve Smith, and it was one afternoon, you'll know if it was Saturday or Sunday, about 5 o'clock, in his bedroom, he got a call, and I was in there, and he was sitting in the edge of the bed. And he asked if it was from Dean Rusk, and went on and on. He looked so depressed when it was over, and I said, what was it, and everything. And I guess Dean Rusk must have told him, or just been very much for it or something. Or did Jack say, go ahead then? I guess that was a decisive phone call.
I think this was a phone call about the airstrike.
Oh, the Dean Rusk wanted to take it away,
I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So anyway, and then Jack just sat there on his bed, and then he shook his head and just wandered around that room, really looking pain almost, and went downstairs. And you just knew he knew what had happened was wrong. But I suppose he was in... You know, it was just such an awful thing. He was just in, and... Well, anyway, usually, as I said, he made his decisions easily, and we'd think about them before, or once he made them, he was happy with them. And that's the one time I just saw him you know, terribly. We were really low, so it was an awful weekend.
Do you think his being low related to that particular decision to about the cancel the airstrike, or to the general decision to have gone ahead with the invasion, or was that fair?
I think it was probably a combination of all of them, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, the invasion in the beginning, and then no airstrike, or, you know, everything, half doing it and not doing it all the way, or should, I don't know. Just some awful thing that had been landed in his lap that there wasn't time to get out of. And then all the things that he told me about Cuba, I can't remember if he told me at the time or later. But, you know, the meetings and how he'd say, oh, my God, the bunch of advisors that we inherited. And then later on, when Taylor was made chief of staff, he'd say, you know, at least I leave that to the next president. Or if Eisenhower left me someone like that, can you imagine leaving someone like Lyman Lemnitzer and, you know, all those people in there, just, I mean, just a hopeless bunch of men. And I can remember one day, would it be after it failed, I guess, or before, at the White House, him especially, I was in the lawn with the children, and he especially came out with Dr. Cardona.
Oh, yes. That was after.
And, you know, well, he thought he'd been wonderful afterwards then. I mean, he just
thought... I think that was the Wednesday afternoon.
Oh.
Because I was sent down to Florida on Tuesday night and brought Adolph Burley and I and brought Dr. Cardona back and took him in late Wednesday afternoon. And I think he brought him out and introduced him to you.
And then he'd, you know, keep shaking his head and said Cardona had been wonderful. But if you want to go back over the chronology of Cuba, there was that off that weekend. Then we went back to Washington. Monday, then Tuesday, we had the congressional reception. And Jack was called away in the middle of it and went over to his office and didn't come back till I was in bed. It was funny because the next year at a congressional reception, he was called away for something else of a crisis. But last year, it just seemed those receptions were always the night something awful happened. So then you say Wednesday was the day everything happened. And I think it was Wednesday we had to have our pictures taken. Or maybe it was Thursday. Jack was as restless as a cat. It was with Mark Shaw, and he had just came up and sat down for about 10 minutes. It's awful. We didn't have any picture of the two of us together that you could mail out. Oh, it's an awful time. You know, and he really looked awful.
Must have been unbearable to go to the Greek dinner in the midst of all this.
Yeah, then we had to go to the Greek dinner that night. We'd had a lunch for them one of those days. Either the day before, the day after, and you know, they were so nice, the Greeks, they were almost our first visitors. But I remember so well when it happened, whatever day it was in the morning, and he came back over to the White House and to his bedroom, and he started to cry, just with me, you know, just for one. And just put his head in his hands and sort of wept. And I've only seen him cry about three times. About twice the winter he was sick in the hospital. You know, just out of sheer discouragement. He wouldn't weep, but some tears would fill his eyes and roll down his cheek. And then that time, and then when Patrick, this summer, when he came back from Boston to me in the hospital, and he walked in the morning about 8 in my room and just sobbed and put his arms around me. And it was so sad because all his first 100 days and all his dreams, and then this awful thing to happen. And he cared so much. He didn't care about his 100 days, but all those poor men. who you'd send off with all their hopes high and promises that we'd back them, and there they were, shot down like dogs who are gonna die in jail. He cared so much about them. And then Bobby came to see me. Obviously there were meetings all the time, probably that afternoon or something in the White House. And Bobby came over to see me and said to, please stay very close to Jack. I mean, just be around all afternoon if I was going to take the children out. In other words, don't leave anywhere. Just to sort of comfort him. Just because he was so sad.
He said something to me that day or the next day about Bobby and wondering about making Bobby head of the CIA. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember him saying that a couple of times. If only he could have had Bobby as head of the CIA. Well, then I suppose he just thought politically that would be too
risky.
Yeah. But he so wished he could have Bobby there. Then I don't know when it was he got John McCone.
About not for another 6 months or so. I got him in the fall. One of the great things, of course, was the fact that the president, having really been led into this by very bad advice, nonetheless never blamed anyone publicly, and had that wonderful Chinese proverb, so-called, you remember? Victory has 100 fathers.
Fathers, a disaster is an orphan.
An orphan. Where did he get that? Do you ever know?
I don't know. You could see if it's in Mao Zedong, because I told you he was reading a lot of Chinese proverbs. But he was always collecting things like that.
How did he feel about? Of course, Lumnitzer, I think it was, and the Joint Chiefs, he held more responsible privately than anyone else, my impression.
Yes, he never really spoken kindly about them, but with sort of hopeless, wry laughter, he talked about Curtis LeMay. Remember the time of the second Cuba? He got a picture of all our airplanes in Florida or all over the country just standing on all the runways, and he called up LeMay.
Right.
There that man was shouting to go and bomb everything and have a little war, and had left all our planes out.
Mm-hmm.
LeMay was hard to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the whole thing, the Joint Chiefs, and then I guess poor Alan Dulles. And then again, there's Dean Rusk. I don't know if you should have, it seems to me if you're going to do it, you should have had air cover. Dean Rusk being timid, but all of that. Jack coming in so late to something and everybody. I just wish if he'd had to do it, they'd let him alone. That was, that was before the 100 days. It was silly. He never liked that 100-day business in the papers, but it was obviously some little press thing from Roosevelt. But, before they were even over. So you can see how early that was in the White House.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about Dulles after this?
Well, he always liked Alan Dulles, and he thought he was an honorable man, and Alan Dulles always had liked Jack. And I think Alan Dulles sort of cracked up. Oh, because a while later he went out of his way to have him to dinner or to make someone, I know what it was, or was it Charlie Reitzman? Yes, Charlie Reitzman and Jane were in Washington, and they were coming to the White House. This was just a couple of weeks after Cuba, or a month. And always Alan Dulles had been their little lion. They'd have him down and trot him out in Florida and everything. And Charlie Reitman was there, and he said he wasn't going to see Alan Dulles. Usually when he was when in Washington, he did, because of the way Alan had bungled the Bay of Pigs. Well, that just disgusted Jack so. He was so loyal always to people in, you know, trouble. And so he took me aside and said, have Dulles over here for tea or for a drink this afternoon. And he made the special effort to come back from his office and sit around with Jane and Charlie Reitzman. You know, and just to show Charlie what he thought of Alan Dulles. And, I mean, it made all the difference to Alan Dulles. I was with him about 5 minutes or 10 before Jack got there. He just looked like, I don't know, Cardinal Mincendi on trial. You know, just a shell of what he was. And Jack came and talked, put his arm around him. What's that thing about Morgan, if you just walk with through the bank with your arm around me? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to give me a loan or anything. Well, wasn't that nice? It was just to show Charlie Reitzman, but it shows something about Jack. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he knew, Dulles had obviously botched everything up. But, you know, he had a tenderness for the man. And then I guess right after that, or Cuba or whatever, he got General Taylor.
Yes, first he got General Taylor to head an investigation. Remember, General Taylor and Bobby made a kind of inquiry into what happened. And then he brought General Taylor into the White House.
That's right.
As a kind of military advisor.
General Taylor always used to be in this gray suit then. And sometimes Jack would say when there'd be a meeting of the Joint Chiefs, you know, that you could just feel these waves going out from them, wondering about what Taylor would be like and what a difficult situation it was for Taylor. And it was to his amazement it worked very well.
Had he known General Taylor before this?
I suppose he'd met him a couple of times because he was always talking about his book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then he'd say, imagine, can you imagine Eisenhower doing that? Whatever all the things were that made General Taylor leave.
Mm-hmm.
General Taylor and General Gavin both wrote books, didn't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But, so he always thought so highly of him. He knew just where, you know, to turn the minute he needed his military advisor.
Mm-hmm. We in the White House staff felt very badly, I mean, quite apart from the general horror of the thing, but we felt that we'd served the president badly. I mean, some had been for the project and others had been against it, but all of us felt we hadn't done the job that the White House staff ought to be doing, in the way that we'd been too intimidated by all these great figures and hadn't subjected the project to the kind of critical examination that it was our job to do. Did he ever comment on that?
No, he never. But I mean, I don't think all of you should feel that way, because look at what you did at the second Cuba. The thing was, you were all cutting your teeth in there, and nobody'd warned you about this thing. And you, all these supposed experts, when you come in fresh yourself, what can you do but sort of take their advice? That's why Lyndon Johnson's so lucky. At least he has a team of people who've been tried. And you hope to God that if the country's been run these past 8 years and there'd been crises, that those men would know something what they were talking about. So he used to talk later, never about his staff, but, you know, about who he was left, who he inherited to turn to for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was rather bitter about.
And when the chips were really down, it was Bobby whom he turned to, wasn't it? More than anyone else to talk to and help counsel with.
That's right, and I remember setting Bobby up with that committee, and I think that's where Bobby and General Taylor's friendship started, because I would say after Jack, General Taylor was the man washing that Bobby is the closest to, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, besides his friends, people in the Justice Department. But, you know, there's this really mutual respect they both have for each other, and it's very touching, a very young man and a man who's at the end of his career.
Mm-hmm. You said in an earlier tape that the times that you remember the president being most depressed and under pressure were the state committee fight in 1956 and the Cuban thing.
Yes, well, not depressed at the state commitment thing. That was more nervous, apprehensive. He couldn't stop talking about it. You know, then he had to do something to win. This one was sort of blundering along. He wasn't running his own show as he was doing in the Massachusetts fight. And then the awful depression when it ended, and caring so about those people. And I think the compassion that shows, well, the way he used to talk to me about Cardona afterwards, and the way then he really felt obligated to get those prisoners out. Was that the Christmas later or two Christmases later?
Two Christmases later.
But you know, when all this thing would go on, first there were the tractors, and Bobby felt so committed to do that. And just at that time, there came an article about Bobby, one of those other boring ones where they say he was ruthless. And I just thought, if they could have known the compassion of that boy, you know, you just couldn't let those people mold away in jail. Probably it would be better if you could have than people see that poor brigade staggering back and, you know, remind you all over, the whole country all over again of the big failure. But just this urgency to get them out. And then Jack would get so belted for the tractor thing. But he had to do whatever thing he could to get them back. Should I tell about that?
Yes.
I have another, I just thought of something else about Bobby's compassion. Last winter, you can find out when it was, that best spy we had in Russia was caught.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Penkowski or Panofsky or something?
Yes.